are listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Hello, I'm Meg Riley, and you've joined us for another episode of The View. Let's have a regular say hello before we get into our conversations. Aisha Hauser out west.
Hi, this is Aisha Hauser. I'm in Seattle, Washington, and it is a glorious gray day here. Michael or Christina?
You go. No. Hi, I'm Christina Rittivetta. I'm joining you from Charlottesville, Virginia.
And good morning, everyone. This is Michael Tino in Peekskill, New York. It's great to be with you.
I'm Doug Mutter in Nashua, New Hampshire.
And I am Lori Stone-Sertoski, running tech for today. I am in sunny Phoenix, Arizona.
And I've asked Lori to stay in front of the chalice today instead of retreating behind it, but she'll still be tweeting and bringing in your questions from over at YouTube and posting relevant things onto the Facebook page. As we came on today, we were having a lively conversation about what congregational polity means. Christina, I thought I loved what you said. Will you say that again about what you think it means and doesn't mean?
Sure. I think a lot of times folks think that congregational polity means that a congregation gets to decide for itself everything about itself. And part of congregational polity, meaning that we don't have some bishop or deacon from on high, you know, telling us who to call or how to organize. But part of congregational polity in Unitarian Universalism, as I understand it and as I covenant with it, is that we do as congregations covenant with other congregations so that we are holding congregations accountable from congregation to congregation. That's part of that covenantal faith that we're part of. Our seven principles say that we're an association of congregations affirming and promoting the seven principles. And part of that is that accountable relationship between congregations. And I think that's something that that we get lost in the whole thought of congregational polity just being about a congregation being its own thing out there in the wind, that you actually are accountable to other congregations in the association.
Yeah, I love that. And I think it's part of white supremacist culture that we don't feel accountable to anyone, you know, me and my horse in the highway and, you know, just that nobody should ever get to tell me. I remember the only time I've ever been held accountable to UU principles was years ago. That there used to be this t-shirt back when I did the GLBT work, and it said, affirming the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And it had this chalice that looked like a pink triangle on it. And so I was wearing it. I was late for a plane. Like I literally, it was just this really, really challenging moment getting to this airplane. So I came up and I was like so amazed to get on it that I like handed the guy my ticket, you know, who was standing there, and he goes, affirming the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And yet you're not even looking at me. And I looked up and I said, oh my God, you're so right. I'm so sorry. And I thought, I wish everyone would do that all the time to me, you know, like, it was just such a wonderful human like realization that I was absolutely betraying what it said on my shirt. And literally, that is the only time that anyone has ever done anything like that to me, except in large groups of people, you know, when we say the inherent worth and dignity of every person, blah, 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 blah. But yeah, that kind of systemic accountability is so largely absent. And I think I was really moved this week, and I want to try to have her on sometime by, and I'm forgetting her last name because I don't really know her, a woman named Sierra. Does someone know her last name?
Sierra Marie.
Marie Garofalo. Okay. Is it Garofalo?
Sierra Marie Garofalo. Is that it?
It's G-E-R-F-A-O.
That's what happens when you don't
know how to pronounce that. We should probably ask Sierra Marie.
Right. We only know her in writing. But she did write a really wonderful statement about accessibility issues, and it was particular to the Ministerial Fellowship Committee, and yet it wasn't. It really was about a whole culture where we make the person who is suffering marginalization or oppression deal with all the accommodations, and then we either accept them or we don't. You know, we who don't have aren't dealing with those issues, and it strikes me that it has widespread application. So I was very excited by, because she made really concrete recommendations to the MFC, which Sarah Lambert says she's already given to the whole MFC. And but I was excited to see it. It was such helpful, clear description of something that happens so often and is usually not so carefully parsed out and laid out. You know, it's just beautifully done. So as I say, I hope we can have her on to talk about it, some other issue, but I wanted to lift that up. And I know I shared it in the CLF coffee hour. We have a lot of people living with this different kinds of disabilities, and they all loved it. I wanted their opinions on it, you know? So anyway, anything else anybody got to talk about today going on in your area or your neck of the woods?
Well, I'm excited to get to talking with Doug. As part of my ministry here in New York, one of the things that we do is a midweek group with the minister. And the midweek group a couple months ago decided that they wanted to focus their conversations on things that were coming out in UU World. Because, you know, they always look for, let's have some way to focus our conversations. And the conversations start somewhere and they go in all sorts of directions. And it's a wonderful small group ministry. And so yesterday, my small group in Mount Kisco discussed your articles, Doug.
Michael, while you're there, why don't you say who Doug is and what his article was?
So Doug Muter is a contributing editor at the UU World, a member of First Parish of Bedford, Massachusetts, and a blogger at the weekly of the weekly SIFT and the Free and Responsible Search. We're really happy to have Doug here. Doug's most recent article in the UU World was about the experience he had of admitting in another article in the UU World that he had been brought up with racism and as a white person, as a racist in our society, and the pushback he received about that. So welcome, Doug.
Welcome. And Doug, we'd love to hear what kind of pushback you got after you published the second article.
In between time, UU World stopped accepting comments on its website. So I did not get nearly so much pushback. And I don't know if...
I'm curious why they did that. That's interesting.
You would have to talk to, Chris Walton or Kenneth Sutton or someone like that. But I think it's that I think a lot of online publications aren't taking comments anymore because the people who comment tend not to be typical of the readership and tend to be more extreme and have more...
A lot of trolls.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Don't read the comments is one of my mantras. It's whether it's something I write or just something I read, the comments usually are just, yeah, I cannot stand to believe that they are representative. You're suggesting, yeah, go ahead.
Chris posted about it. And my understanding from what I remember, this happened a few weeks ago, is he said, right, if people did comment, it was usually negative, but also that a lot more conversations happened when people shared articles and happened on Facebook. So he also just, I think it was probably a combination, but it sounded like what he experienced as more alive was when folks shared articles on Facebook and then would have conversation or, you know, comments back and forth from there.
Cool. Okay, well, so you didn't get formal comments. I'm curious then how it felt to write that and how you, how you felt it was received and just the general topic of saying, sure, I'm part of this white supremacist world. What else is new? You know, it's Tuesday. So, how is that just to walk around with
I thought I'd say a little bit about what prompted the original article to start with, which was that I was listening to someone give a sermon about subtle racism. And it was a young person who had grown up UU in a professional class setting. And the racism was so subtle, I had trouble identifying with it. And I felt like it didn't really make space for people like me to talk about the racism we grew up with, because it was just an order of magnitude less. And so I thought I would write something to try and create that space that I wish I had, that I would go on and talk about somewhat less subtle racism. I mean, you know, not the real KKK style, but still more overt than just, you know, very microaggressions. And so that's what I did. And the surprising thing, the first real pushback I got was I was at church not long after the article came out. And someone who I knew, of course, being at the same church, walked up to me and just started the conversation. And my article was called, "Of Course I'm Racist." And this person just walked up to me and very boldly said, "You're not racist." So I had thought that confessing my own racism wouldn't be as controversial as calling someone else a racist, but it turned out that it did set off a lot of the same things. And what came out in a lot of comments was this feeling that, of course, you know, in telling the story of my own racism, I'm talking about how I was brought up, which was in the Midwest, in a white working class neighborhood, in a small town. And people took each of those adjectives as indictments of the entire class, that I'm saying that white people are all racists and small towns are all racists and working class people are all racists. And there just seemed to be, as careful as I tried to be to own my experience and not project outwards, people were very inclined to just assume that projection outwards, that I was indicting these large classes of people when actually I was just trying to make my own confession.
It's really interesting. Well, Michael, go ahead.
And you know, it's interesting, Doug. You know, part of your confession, as I experienced it, was understanding that this is the culture that shaped me. That I was, and I can use I statements for me. I, as a white person, growing up in big city Northeast, was fundamentally shaped by a culture that is white supremacist, right? That is racist. And that taught me certain things about myself and about other people and how to have privilege as I walk through the world, right? So that's, I mean, is that a fundamental indictment of our culture? Maybe it is. I mean, maybe it's a fundamental indictment of our culture. But like, we have to be okay with making that claim in some way. And you know, that you didn't say everything about our culture is horrible,
right? And I didn't say that everybody who shares any of my background is guilty of something.
Well, I think that's the trick, right? Is that we assume that being racist is being guilty of something, or that it's bad and evil, and you know, and I mean, I always think of Bill Jones saying, you know, you don't look for racism in what's bad, look in what's good for racism, because it's in all of it. And so I think that sense that if you say something's racist, you are condemning it, is why we're also, I mean, because that's part of white supremacy, to teach us that. Therefore, even you'll hear someone who just murdered Black people and their siblings are like, they're not racist. And you're like, what do you have to do? I mean, really, you use one word makes you racist in this country. And if you don't use that word, nothing else that you do makes you racist. And it's that whole thing of racism equals being a bad person, right? So God, we should do anything but acknowledge that.
This is something I mentioned briefly at the end of the column, and then I hit harder in there are a couple of sermons I've given on the same topic since, one of which is on free and responsible search now, that this whole notion of guilt, because that's one of the ways that the conversation gets shut down, that people say, oh, you just want me to feel guilty, and what good does that do? And what I'm talking about, the kind of racism I was talking about was the kind where it's just affected my whole sense of perception where I just grew up with the idea that if you're talking about people, you're talking about white people. And when Black people show up, that's an exception. You have to look at all your rules all over again to see if they still make sense now that Black people are around, because they're some entirely different category. And that's not something that you experience directly moment to moment as a sense of hatred or wanting to do bad things to people. It's just a negligence, an omission, a not seeing. And what I tried to emphasize in there is that that's not, that when it causes me to do things that are wrong, then that's what I feel guilty about and try to correct. But just that sense of perception is something that I experience more as damage than as guilt. That I feel like my upbringing has crippled me in certain ways that causes me to screw up and to offend people I don't mean to offend and to do wrong things I don't intend to do. And damage, I think, isn't something to feel guilty about. It's something to recognize and map and try to work around so that you do, you transmit as little of that damage as you can. And so I tried at the end to shift the emphasis away from guilt into more of management of your damage.
And so, yeah, I would say that two things there. I would just lift up that we're trying to move away from the idea of crippling being something that's negative, and that's our ableist language coming through. But the idea that when we're feeling guilt and shame, that is a time to explore curiosity. I think Aisha and I say this a lot in the teach-in when we're doing the teach-in webinars, and when we're trying to get people to really come out from behind that thing that freezes people, that guilt or that perception of shame that goes with the guilt, and recognize it, acknowledge it, and move past that. And some of the easiest ways for people to do that is to get curious. Like, why do I feel that way? Like, oh, I had that moment of feeling really crappy. What's that all about? And as opposed to being super defensive about, you know, pushing back and saying, no, we're not racist. I'm not racist. How could you say that? And get into that place of curiosity. And I know, you know, my growing edge again is ableism. It's I've very clearly defined it for myself as an area in which I need to do more work. And still at times I get to that point of like, wait a second, you know, can we just use metaphor? And, you know, don't we, you know, can't we just be this way? And why are you trying to make me feel bad for the way in which I'm trying to express myself? And those are the moments where I'm like, oh boy, why am I feeling that? What is it about that that's kicking all of that up for me? So I really appreciated it in that article where you said, you know, to kind of frame it as that damaged part of us. And I think it's helpful to do that sometimes for white people. Where I don't want it to go too far is the abdication of that responsibility. You know, I'm a damaged person. I can't help it. This is just the way, you know, I was brought up. It has to go further than that.
I also think arguing about the words or staying in defensive mode is also a way to abdicate. Well, I'm not. So one of the things people still say, I heard it yesterday. Well, you know, if you just use different words, you'd have more people on your side. And I'm like, so you think if slaves asked nicely to not be in bondage, it would have worked? Is that really what we're talking about? So I, you know, at some point I've now started saying, I'm not going to argue the earth is flat. I'm not going to argue that climate change is real. And I'm not arguing that white supremacy culture is real. Those three are the same thing for me. And so I appreciate, Doug, that you come not only curiosity, but humility. It's like, look, this is a reality that white America needs to deal with 2018 Trump, right? This is what we need to, because if we don't, if white America does not deal with this, you're next. It's not, you know, it's not just black and brown people. It's now white people are going to get divided. And we're, so this is something, talk about the interdependent web. But I think what I've realized is this notion that we're not going to talk about white supremacy culture, or we're not going to talk about certain words, or we're not going to claim being racist is another way to abdicate. It's just simply, I'm not sure what the magic words are. You let me know, white people, what are the magic words that are going to bring true liberation to people? Because I promise you, black people in chains and indigenous people who've been the victims of genocide would have used them. So that's my soapbox.
One of the things, I'm from the Midwest, Doug, and I find in working class culture and I definitely, that fragility, I can recognize and see it in my people and myself, that fragility and that almost like contact fragility, right? Of it, you're not actually indicting or pointing the finger outward, but you're pointing it inward. And yet by association, you're knocking up against the fragility of people who are in similarly culturally situated. And one of the things that I have done, and imperfectly, is I've tried, I took Jay Smooth, Ill Doctrine, has a video blog called Ill Doctrine, and he has a segment where he talks about how we should stop thinking about racism as being some kind of indictment, like being called racist. But if we could reprogram our brains to think when someone points out our racism, being equivalent to like, you've got something stuck in your teeth. And so you've got a little something racist stuck in your teeth. Whenever someone tells you you've got something stuck in your teeth, you thank them. You're like, oh, I've got to get that out. I'm walking around in this like, you know, state that I don't want to be in. And so what a different world we would live in, right? If we could cut off that defensive and fragile response and just be like, of course I want to address that. Let me get me to the bathroom. Get me to a mirror. Let me get that literally look in the mirror and get that racism out of my teeth.
And one good thing about that is that, okay, yeah. One good thing about that is that when someone tells you you have something in your teeth, you don't immediately feel like, oh, I must be a horrible person that I have something in my teeth. It's that this is something that happens to people, and now it's happening to me, and I need to deal with it.
Right. We all eat salads. I mean, it happens. And we all, you know, those of us who are socialized as white, were raised in this kind of toxic stew of white supremacy culture. And so we have to address it.
I think we all were raised in that toxic stew, regardless of our race. It's just that those of us who are white were taught that we were superior in that culture. And, I think part of what hurts us is that one of the traits of white supremacy culture is never to want to be wrong, you know, that being right is just really critical. And I was thinking, getting ready for this, of a pivotal experience in my life, which I used to run the GLBT office. So I was out doing workshops about homophobia in churches all the time and dealing with a lot of people telling me what was wrong with me, or, you know, lots of stuff all the time. And my partner at the time was a painter, and she had an art show at a Unitarian church. And so she did a conversation with the church, anybody who came one day. And this white man said, that part of your painting is orange and it should be purple. And she was not a Unitarian Universalist, but she had been a kindergarten teacher for years. And her response to him was, it sounds like you want to make a purple painting, which I just loved so much. And I sometimes feel like there must be an equivalent response when people come and tell you what you should have done or what you're, you know, like, sounds like you want to, you know, like, make a purple painting, because it was exactly the same energy I was dealing with all the time about something I had no emotion tied up into. And he got furious when she said that and got out a color wheel and started pointing. And it's like he doubled down in this position of that it should have been purple, you know. And it was so helpful to me because I just went, oh, I get it. Part of this is bias. And part of this is this culture is like this, you know, about everything. And we've all seen it in other ridiculous ways in our congregations, that the fights that emerge might be about really stupid stuff. But I think what's especially awful about white supremacy culture here is that it has that it should be orange response, you know, to the painter. So it's, you know, what you've experienced, Doug, which was about how you learned to be in white supremacist culture, but it would be different people saying the same thing if Michael did, or I did, or others of us who grew in different, who are white, grew up in different iterations. And then people like Aisha and Christina, the people of color, who often are the ones kind of lifting it up and really parsing it out for us because they can see it so much more clearly, end up being, you know, kill the messenger. That it's like, if you didn't name that, it would not be a problem here, because I felt fine before you named it. I was just fine over here.
That's exactly it. I invented white supremacy March 2017. So I'm start. But now if somebody tries to argue white supremacy with me, I'm going to say, it sounds like you want to make a purple painting. That's what I'm going to say.
One of the ways this whole thing fits a flaw in, well, a feature or just a detail of Unitarian Universalism in a deadly way, is that we are such a verbal culture, that we're so attached to the dictionary and being correct and having the exact right word for things. And so there's this broader defense that happens all over, but it's hard for us to filter it out in our community, even though we'd like to, of we want to get the words exactly right. And so the guy who came up to me and said, you know, you're not racist, it's because he had a different definition of racism, and I didn't fit that definition. And we end up diverting ourselves very often into, you know, what should these words mean, rather than what is the subject we're talking about?
Yeah, it's interesting, Doug. It was actually part of the conversation I had with my group in the congregation yesterday. Part of the conversation was about that one of the ways that white supremacy culture replicates itself is by teaching us that racism looks and sounds a very narrow, particular way, so that everything else that really is racism, that really is white supremacy, is not that, right? You know, Meg said there's one word that if you don't say, you know, you're not a racist. And I think that that's actually part of the way in which white supremacy replicates itself, by teaching us, oh yeah, that's not racism.
And I think we've seen that in corollary to, you know, what the Parkland students, their demands of, you know, gun control and particularly regarding assault weapons, and people saying, you know, have you seen what they've written? You know, we can't possibly do what they've written. And, you know, their platform is just too broad, and, you know, we can't do these really specific things. And, you know, my response to that has been, you know, they're asking not to die, right? So our children in our schools are asking not to die. Can we do that? Can we just do that so that it doesn't get into that granularity of you're using the wrong word, you're using the wrong phrase. You know, people want to argue about, you know, whether or not assault rifles, you know, whether or not that's a militia weapon in order to protect themselves. And, you know, my response at this point is, our children's lives are more important. That, you know, I'm not going to have a debate with you about gun control. You can ask me all the different ways in which you want to parse it. Our children's lives are more important. Black lives are more important. Latino, Indigenous lives are more important than all of these really granular ways in which you want to stop the conversation and stop the accountability for that conversation. So that's one of the things I really appreciated, Doug, about what you wrote was that trying to come out behind, you know, from behind that defensive mechanism of kind of what Aisha said. We're just not going to debate anymore whether or not the earth is flat and whether or not white supremacy exists. We're moving on from that. We've established it. We've established that our children's lives are at risk. We've established that Black lives are at risk. We've established what we need to establish. We're now moving on from that, you know, trying to get the facts right into actually saving these lives. So.
And I'll just say, having been around a while, that back in the 90s, different language was the problem. And it was all about that language, which wasn't white supremacy, you know. And so now watching this, it's like, I remember this. We've did this big time. And even people who hadn't been to anti-racism training, the language was so offensive that they couldn't go, you know. And so, yeah, it is really... And I remember when Alandria at GA this year said, and I was just so happy she said it, look around the room in plenary. There are people affected by the words you say. I just thought, what a concept that people look up from their paper and actually acknowledge that there are people in the room who are affected by words rather than obsessing about the words. Aisha, I wanted to lift up, said, when the guy said, you're not racist, Aisha wrote, he had a comfortable definition of racism. And Aisha, I could say what I think you meant by that, but would you say more about it?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's been super, super clear, and you, I think, affirmed what was, what I've been come to the conclusion is that white liberals especially want to be comfortable, want to do anti-racism work, anti-oppression, whatever the hell word works, in comfort. They want to write the check. They want to go on a march. They want to wear a pink pussy hat. And then we're good. Oh, but wait, what do you mean, Doug Muter? You're saying that you're saying you're racist, which means you're saying I'm racist. And that's uncomfortable. And so there's what we being Unitarian Universalists, haven't done well. And I've said this before. It's kind of my mantra. We haven't taught our people to sit in discomfort. We want to do spirituality in comfort. We want to do helping. We want to be the saviors, white saviors, white liberals want to be saviors you use in comfort. And I don't know what that is. I don't, that sense of entitlement, that sense of, and it's kind of at some point, it's willful ignorance. And so this man had a comfortable definition of racism. It's those people out there. Obviously, if they would just be educated, if they would, you know, this myth that the people who elected our current regime were poor working class white people, it's a myth. The facts are well-educated, wealthy white people, and some you use, hate to break it to y'all, voted for Trump. So we if we're not dealing in reality, we can't fix reality, right? So that's what I meant by that, is this notion of coming into things. Because guess what? People in marginalized communities have lived in discomfort from day one. We're othered for one reason or another, whether you're an immigrant, a Black person, LGBT person, we're othered. And so when the teacher mispronounced my name starting in kindergarten for the next 13 years, that I had to learn to live with that, right? So if you've never had to live in discomfort, now it's like you get resentful and upset about it. So that's what my long answer.
Well, and I think Aisha, as someone who was socialized and brought up as white in this country, so the flip side is I was brought up in comfort and taught that I should expect it and I deserve it, right? So when I'm made uncomfortable, like the tapes start playing in my head that, wait, I don't deserve this. I need to get, so yes, I needed to be taught how to sit in discomfort because your life is more important than my comfort, right? I mean, like I had to be taught that. Because that's not the tape that came like factory installed as a white person in the United States. But our people, I think our people need to be taught that. Doug?
Well, and so much of our consumer culture is all around the idea that if you are uncomfortable, this is a problem and you need to buy a product and solve it. You should flip on the air conditioner. Discomfort is not something that we're taught to live with in any sense. And so when it comes up in an emotional sense of gee, maybe it isn't true that everyone just needs to reach the same level of enlightenment that I've achieved, then that feels wrong somehow. I ought to be able to flip a switch somewhere and make that go away.
You know, I was brought up Unitarian, liberal parents in West Virginia, and we were definitely the good guys. We were the saviors. We were the good white people in the civil rights movement. And so when I went to seminary, I took a class when I lived in Boston, I took a class with Carter Hayward on liberation theology, and she asked us to write how our race impacted our theology. This was in 1992. I couldn't do it. I wrote about being Appalachian and fat and a lesbian and all these ways that I feel othered. And she gave me an F. She said, great, but that isn't what I didn't ask you about any of that. And talk about uncomfortable. I was furious. I was like, ugh. And if she hadn't been a Southern lesbian, I probably would have chalked it up to homophobia. But as it was, I was put back on myself. And I thought, I don't even know how to talk about being white. I mean, I it's not even something I've learned as an identity. I'm just, as Doug said, I'm a person. That's what I am. And so it took a lot of learning. And it took, for me, really immersing myself then in a Black church and going, having my whiteness reflected to me all the time. And for me, it does take going to environments where I am in the minority to see the cultural references I don't get, to see the culture, because as a white person, it can be so easy in Minnesota, it can be very easy to just live in a world where whiteness is reflected back to me all the time as people. And I never have to get uncomfortable. And it's deeply humbling to figure out how endless. I keep thinking, okay, now I get it. And then something else happens. I go, oh shit, I know. and then something else happens, and then something, and so I feel like, okay, at some point I got it. Okay, I'm never gonna really get this. This is a lifelong journey, and as Christina said, if I can stay curious about it, it's a really amazing educational experience that I, again, and I went to a Black high school because my parents were liberal and we wouldn't move when all the other white people did and blah, 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 you know, but still that doesn't really matter. It's just the air we breathe. And I'll say one other thing. I raised a kid of color when Jai was three. Jai, and we had this liberal bubble idea that we could just protect our child. And when Jai was three, Jai looked at me and said, do only brown people steal things? And I thought, what? We don't watch movies. We don't. What are you? You know, Sesame Street, where it's just the culture. I mean, it's like in the air we breathe. And anyway, it's so when people are like, no, I don't. Why would I bring it up to my white child? I'm like, because kids of color are figuring it out at age three, you know. And at that point, I got it. Like, OK, we're going to be talking about this the whole way through, which.
And white kids get it too. They white kids, by the time they're three, also know that white is better. And there's a book by Ibram Kendi, a black scholar who's extraordinary. It's called Stamped from the Beginning. And one of the things he talks about is so what he said, I went into this book writing it thinking that there was ignorance at play, that people, you know, who were slave owners or were, it was ignorance. And he said, what I realized is white people who wanted, you know, basically free labor, right, and decimating Native Americans had to make it okay. And the way to make it okay is to dehumanize black and brown bodies. And so this whole system has been created for, you know, in white supremacy culture, but even more insidious, is to make slavery excusable. They used God, the Bible. So this was all by design. And that was one of the things that Ibram Kendi said, Dr. Ibram Kendi said, that was a surprise to him, that this wasn't ignorance. It wasn't white people being ignorant. It was white people in power by design, dehumanizing black people and brown people and Native Americans. And he said the way out is that it's not just about learning. It's, I mean, yes, it's, you know, changing hearts and minds, sure. And It's policy. We now have to, just like policy dehumanized people, we now need to fix it. And so some of this is unlearning what's been learned, and it has to be systemic change in a big way. And then sure, it would be great to change people's hearts. At this point, I'm like, look, change your behavior. Whether or not your heart has changed, I can't do anything about that. That would be lovely, wouldn't it? But really, we need to change policy and we need to change how we operate, including in our UU churches, where we can do that if we want to.
And following what Aisha's saying is that, and what Meg brought up is most, if not all, I never say all about everything, but most people of color can tell you what white culture is. Like we have a PhD in white culture in order to be able to survive it in this country. And so the fact that policy change needs to come from the people who understand those dualities of culture, the idea that you can't center the voices from the margin in order, without centering voices from the margin, that you're still somehow going to be able to create the change that we need in the world, it's impossible because the majority, like you said, Meg, the majority of white people don't know that how they're culturally white, how that moves in our nation, in our culture. But the majority of people of color do. We know exactly how that moves. And if we survived it, we know the ways in which it needs to change. So when we talk about listening to Black and Brown people and then doing what we say we need them to do, it's not just about liberation. It's about acknowledging that these folks actually have a skill set that is something to be valued. And I think when we get into the conversation about qualifications and who is qualified to do what, I mean, we're here a year later after we had talked about, you know, white supremacy in the UUA and the hiring, you know, controversy of last year, and the Commission on Institutional Change is going to be coming out with their initial report on that next month. And, you know, when I think back to that time, I think back to that conversation about qualifications and that idea of who is qualified and who gets to decide what those qualifications are, and how can white people, and this is a question for you all, understand or can you understand what those skills are for those people who are living in both worlds, who can understand that there is a white culture and the ways in which navigating that as a person of color are different even than a white person, but that we can actually see very clearly what that is.
Some of those themes really came through to me a few weeks ago when I went to the new African-American part of the Smithsonian, that museum that has just opened. And spending the day there and realizing that, you know, all this time I have thought of myself as a well-educated, well-read person, and to continually run into things where it's like, how did I not know about this event? How have I never heard of this person? And to have this constant sense of ignorance, it was shocking to my self-image, even though I should have known to expect that.
You know, and to answer your question, Christina, one of the things that I've done in my other work back in Indianapolis was I worked with a surge chapter, that's a showing up for racial justice chapter there, and we would do white ally training at the request of our accountability partners, our Black Lives Matter partners, and it was only like a 3-hour training, but then we would do a 6-month curriculum monthly via house meetings. And the first meeting we would have, we would ask everyone to read excerpts from Debbie Irving's book, Waking Up White and Finding Myself in the Story of Race. And then we would ask them to read that book throughout that 6 months as well, just to get, because it's a very eye-opening. It really gets to what you're asking, is like, can we actually understand ourselves in that story of race without it just being about studying people of color, right? And so we literally do a full 6 month curriculum on whiteness. It's all about whiteness. And I think people are really surprised. They think we're going to be talking about Black history and talking about, you know, this particular event. And that, I'm like, no, we haven't even begun to scratch the surface of how whiteness is the problem. And so this is where we're starting. And only then do we even get close. And so we have every month is like white fragility, white supremacy culture, white, centering. We just do intersectionality and like how feminism has like completely, you know, white feminism is a thing. And I mean, just, you know, we've screwed it up at every turn. And that literally is that 6 months of sitting with discomfort and, you know, putting that spotlight back on ourselves and really having to start to articulate. And if they're still with us at the end of 6 months, I'm like, okay, maybe they'll be organizers. And then we move. And we've got, you know, it's worked out pretty well. But there is attrition, I will tell you.
I was very struck reading Tendaka's book, Learning to Be White, for pretty much the same reason. Just to realize that, you know, whiteness is not something that goes back in history that far. And that if you get back, you know, Shakespeare didn't think he was white, he thought he was English. And to realize the constructed nature of it was surprising to me.
I just typed in the box that I'm really curious. This is my question for white people here. What are the magic words? We can't use white supremacy culture. We can't use racist or anti-racist. We can't use even the word now white. People have, you know, it's okay to be white. What are the magic words? What's going to work? I don't know. And I seriously, I mean, I'm being a little bit facetious, but I'm also like, okay, I've been told if only you just used other words, you'd have more people on your side. And so what are they? What are the magic words?
I think what you said before from that book, that the laws, I mean, what he's saying is consciousness follows law changes. It's not the other. It's not like everyone gets conscious and then they change the law. The law makes people think differently because they act differently because they have to. And, you know, it's like I never wanted to put on a seatbelt. I mean, it's always more comfortable not to. But now my car beeps at me, you know, and it's really more annoying than the, you know, so that's because of law changes and culture changes. And so I think the magic words are change the laws. You know, I mean, I think.
We can just go around beeping at people.
Purple. You want to make a purple painting?
I often quote the line out of 1776 where John Adams says, "By God, this is a revolution. We've got to offend somebody."
I think what
I have this vision in my head now of those buzzers from the game Taboo. I don't know if you've ever played that game. There's a buzzer, and if you say the words you're not supposed to say, someone is supposed to buzz at you. So I have this vision of like a gang of people at General Assembly with buzzers going around, buzzing at people. But you know the problem with that, and I'll take this funny sort of notion and turn it serious, is that there aren't specific words. I mean, there are some specific words, right? But that white supremacy culture finds ways of using whatever language is available to it, right? So if we just say, "No, I'm sorry, you can't say X, Y, or Z, or we're gonna buzz you," right? the car is gonna ding because your seatbelt's not on. The culture will find different words to use to mean the same thing. And so we have to dig deeper into, you know, why it exists at all. And, you know, Aisha, I think it was you that started, you know, talking about how you know, the whole colonization of the world by European powers was predicated on dehumanizing black and brown people, right? I mean, that started it. Like that's, and if we continue to live in a society that venerates that, that holds that up as sort of the ideal for the way society should be, then we don't really have a hope of finding the magic word that's going to liberate folks.
Also, one of the traps in this discussion, I think, and you hear this whenever any of the groups try to push back, whether it's whites or men or whoever it is who is in the privileged group, that we want to be given a set of rules. That, and we want this rule-based system that if I just obey these rules, then I'm good. You know, if I don't say these words, if I don't do this action, and so on. And what that denies is, I mean, prejudice of all sorts, it's not really a rule-based system. There's no way around it without engaging empathy and compassion. You can't just stick to a set of rules and then you'll be good. And so one of the traps is that people will say, well, just tell me what words I can't say, or you know, with sexism, you know, tell me I can't do this and I can't do that. And give me this set of rules that if I keep them, then I'm good. And I think we need to keep coming back to the idea that there is no set of rules for being a good person. Ultimately, you do have to have empathy for other people, and you have to think through things in a more complicated emotional way.
Aisha, the question in all seriousness is critical for us to answer as white folks who are a little further along on this, the wheel of allyship is what I think of in my mind. This, I don't know if people have heard of it, but there's like a six-sided pie, like it comes into a half circle. And the idea is that people are actively oppressive, passively oppressive, kind of neutral, and then actively trying to be more allied, and then all the way down into like just a stronger allyship is practiced by them. And so the idea is you can't get from one piece of the, you can't jump from like one to four. You've got to go through each piece. And the, I think it's different tactics for different sections of the pie. So, and I believe that people of color shouldn't have to be dealing directly with the people in those lower ends of the pie. I believe white folk, that is our work. That's literally white folk work, is to deal with the people in the lower ends of that pie. And so the magic words in my mind for those folks, for the people who are passively oppressive or even actively oppressive people, the magic words are, Lori, Meg, can you have a conversation with these people? Because I ain't got time for that. I mean, that in my mind is literally where people of color should be. Now, I totally get that we can't be there, you know, to do that. You're getting that all the time. And that is where we have to be reaching out and doing that congregational-based change work, community-based change work, and a large scale. And it's work that's going to span generations, because it's just, we're constantly creating new generations of people with whole new, you know, back in that lower end part of the pie. So, and then live as though, I mean, for me, it is like, I have to, I mean, it's an imperative to do this work, but the conversations I can have with white folks who are still in that really kind of reactive, fragile place are, there are conversations that I have to have relationship with them before I can even have them, because they'll respond to me in the same way, very reactive. So I was in a place where we were being asked to call out another surge chapter in another part of the state by another Black Lives Matter organization. We didn't have very many relationships with those folks, and yet they were doing some really egregious things. So we had to spend time just building basic relationship before we could start doing the calling out, or the calling in, as it were. So And so it's, unfortunately, I don't know that there are magic words other than protect your own emotional labor when you can and get other people to have to do it when it's in that bad place, that lower end place. So
I do that in my congregation. I have a few white folks that I've asked for that. And I say, look, if I get an email, you know, I had somebody send me an email saying, you know, I could help you find words. And I'm like, you know, here's someone else you could speak to, because I'm just not doing that. So that's actually the strategy I've started using. So thank you all.
We're coming towards the end of the hour. Doug, thank you for, giving us a hook to have an important conversation. And your blogs always are interesting. I know we had you on before talking about how the South really won the Civil War. What are you thinking about these days? What are you researching, or what are you...
I'm reading a lot about democracy and the importance of norms in democracy, and how the loss of those norms is worrisome, even if the literal letter of the Constitution is still being kept. And so, like, right now I'm in the middle of reading a new book out called How Democracies Die. And so that's kind of what I'm thinking about these days.
Well, we look forward to your blogs about that and other things. It's always a pleasure to spend time. I forget who's next week. Lori, can you call that up so I can have it?
It's the president, and I know that because I'm going to miss it. It's Susan Frederick Gray, yeah. Carrie McDonald.
Thank you.
So bummed. It's going to be less controversial without me. Let's just name it.
I'm sorry you'll be gone. Darn it. Yeah, it is. It's Susan Frederick Gray and Carrie McDonald coming to talk about what's new at the UUA.
Ho-hum, boring show, president of the UUA. Okay.
That means it's going to be April already, which I'm in total denial about. Oh, my gosh. Well, it's been wonderful to spend an hour with everyone. Wanted to tip my hat to Daryl Dyke, who made a comment we didn't get to, but thanks for commenting. We always appreciate that. See you all next week. And again, thanks so much, Doug.
This has been an episode of The View. If you would like to learn more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.